I'm Sarah Posner, and this is The Posner Show, and today my guest is my colleague, Catherine Joyce, who is the author of a new book called The Child Catchers, Rescue, Trafficking, and the New Gospel of Adoption. I'm going to show it to the camera. You can't see me, but there it is so people can see what the cover looks like. It is an in-depth investigation of the relatively new movement within evangelicalism to adopt the world's orphans. And I have to say that for someone like me who covers religion and evangelicalism in particular, it was a really eye-opening, in-depth, well-reported book on a topic that I think people don't really know that much about, apart probably from maybe personal experience. So, I mean, obviously, let's just put out there on the table that while your book addresses some very troubling ethical lapses mm-hmm. within the what might be called the adoption industry, there are a lot of well-intentioned people who adopt babies with the best goals in mind and whose adoptions go smoothly and there's no ethical issue at all. So this is not any kind of indictment of adoption or evangelical adoption writ large. Yes. So, but something that was, I think that you lay out really well at the beginning of the book is how this movement to adopt within evangelicalism went, you say that it went viral, which is a term that evangelicals use themselves. And what was interesting to me is the way that this developed almost as, in part, as a reaction to criticism that evangelicals have received because of their anti-abortion activism. You know, and the criticism goes something like, you know, you seem to care so much about the fetus, but you don't seem to care that much about the child once it's outside right. the womb. And it seemed to be a little bit of a reaction to that. And it seemed to also have a salvation story within a salvation story within a salvation story.
Yes.
And I was hoping that maybe you could talk about that a little bit more, because the motivation, like you say, it was in part a reaction to criticism that they had gotten for anti-abortion activism, but it was also driven by other factors. And can you talk a little bit more about that religious imperative?
Absolutely. I think that's exactly right. I think when I started looking at the Christian adoption movement, and I guess I started looking at it a couple of years after it had really kind of come into its own. I started looking about 2008, 2009. There were a few key motivations. One was the expansion of anti-abortion, or as they would say, pro-life principles. They would say that they wanted to make a movement that was more whole life, that was creating positive solutions rather than just negative protests. I think a lot of Christians mm-hmm. expressed this sense that they were tired of being known for what they were against, and they wanted to be for something. I think adoption has long been tied to abortion politics, especially in the U.S. It's always been this kind of pat answer that the anti-abortion side could give. You know, if you have an unwanted pregnancy, you don't need to, you know, go on and be a parent if you're not prepared for that. But here is the alternative to abortion. It's adoption. So there's always been that tie. But I think with this new movement, a few things were added on to that anti-abortion message. Probably the most kind of theological one was the idea of adoption, as we know it, earthly adoption, reflecting Christian salvation. So a lot of evangelical theologians and leaders who were writing books about this started kind of parsing out what this would look like. And what they came up with was this idea that what they call horizontal adoption, so adoption kind of on the earthly plane, adoption of children by parents, by Christian parents, that this mirrors what they call vertical salvation, vertical adoption, which is a salvation, Christian salvation by God. So they're saying that parents adopting children mirrors the way that God adopts Christians, and that this was therefore kind of the most perfect image of their faith and a way that Christians could really live out, their convictions and, you know, kind of put their faith in action. And I think a third thing that was a real strong motivation and that some of the leaders spoke to me about was an idea among a lot of conservative evangelicals that they had ceded the territory of doing good works, of social justice work, of helping the poor mm-hmm. to liberal churches decades ago. And right. they felt, you know, all right, we've been left out over here as, you know, the Christians who only care about doctrinal purity, and we don't feel like that fully represents our faith. We want to be doing something that is social justice, that is, you know, working for the social good. And adoption emerged as this kind of perfect option that allowed them to be working on something charitable for the social good without challenging some of their pre-existing ideas about, you know, sexuality or, you know, the dependence of adults who are being helped by social systems. So,
right. I was going to say it doesn't really challenge their concept of what government should
Absolutely.
Do.
Absolutely.
And it really feeds their idea of that the family and the individual and the church should be performing those social justice
yeah.
Good works as opposed to government providing social
yeah,
services.
Exactly. It's, in a way, it's kind of like the most privatized answer to the question of child poverty is,
right.
you know, the church and individual Christians taking this on very personally in their own homes.
Now, so you describe in the book how this movement went viral almost, and
yeah.
there were, you know, it did have a viral component to it, but at the same time, there were also very important leaders within evangelicalism who helped promote it. So it wasn't, you know, yes, it was viral, but there was also some deliberate advocacy by some of evangelicalism's leading advocates of presenting a less focus on abortion only kind of face for evangelicalism. And so some of the people involved, and there are a lot of people in the book who probably most readers would have never heard of. They're not particularly well-known figures, probably outside of their own church circles. But there are a couple of figures who are household names. One of them is Rick Warren, who you discussed at length in the book, his role in promoting international adoption, and Russell Moore, who teaches at the Southern Baptist Convention's leading seminary and was also just appointed to replace Richard Land at the Southern Baptist Convention's Ethics and Religious Liberty Commission, which is basically its Washington presence. So, you know, politically speaking, you know, these two figures are very important people, and they've played a big role in this movement.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think, you know, isn't that kind of the thing about viral movements, is often they end up having leaders who are, you know, inspiring people at the top, that this is not necessarily some kind of grassroots thing that just sprung up out of people's hearts, but something that has been, you know, people have been working on and organizing for quite a while. So that was certainly the case with the Christian adoption movement. Starting with Rick Warren, I think looking back at the history of this, it seemed there was one organization called the Christian Alliance for Orphans that began in a small way with a handful of leaders back around 2004. And then in 2007, that seemed to be a watershed moment for this movement, when a lot of leaders, including a lot of kind of big name evangelical leaders in the United States, met in Colorado Springs with a Focus on the Family staff and were talking about orphan care and adoption as something that Christians really need to be involving themselves in. And, you know, kind of people getting up and standing and saying, I think Rick Warren said, and I'm paraphrasing, but, you know, as Christians, we do a lot of railing against sexuality, against, you know, people who, you know, end up acting in ways that we find sexually immoral, or, and we're not doing anything to help them. And I think he was already starting to work, he and his wife, on HIV/AIDS issues in their own way.
Right.
So I think that, you know, this was his way to come back and kind of present this and say, we need to be working corporately as Christians on, you know, more positive things, and what could kind of be more positive than helping children who are called orphans. So out of this meeting came kind of some of the probably most serious organized activism. Obviously, you know, there are books and there are actions and there are leaders who predate this, but this was, I think, certainly one kind of turning point moment. And I think that Los Angeles Times wrote about it at the time, saying, you know, all these evangelical leaders are like going back out around the country to their home congregations, and they are going to go preach about the need for Christians to be involved in adoption and helping orphan children. So that was one. Sorry, go ahead.
That's very interesting, because at the time that was happening, I wasn't really aware that this meeting had taken place and that this was starting to be discussed in this way. But, you know, I was covering Washington politics at the time, and that was something that was really being pushed by proponents of what they like to call common ground solutions to the abortion conflict, for lack of a better word. And that was something that they very much focused on, that the idea that, and that obviously wasn't new, that the idea that a woman who facing an unwanted pregnancy should carry the child to term and then give it up for adoption. But the fact that this was being discussed and promoted more as a policy aim in Washington, and also by some political candidates, including one named Barack Obama, it's interesting that these things were happening simultaneously, of this political push and also this push at the sort of church level, for lack of a better way.
Yeah, absolutely. One of the more interesting things that I came across, or, you know, is very interesting for me because we're recalling that election, was this, I think, 2008 op-ed in the Wall Street Journal, where a columnist was telling John McCain that he could better appeal to evangelicals who were kind of lukewarm about him by highlighting the fact of his adopted daughter. And interestingly, the same daughter had been the target of a really ugly smear campaign by the Bush campaign during the primary in the previous.
In 2000.
So that was kind of interesting.
Yeah, that is interesting. Yeah. So let's talk about Russell Moore, because, you know, I think that his star is unquestionably rising with his new position with the Southern Baptist Convention. And he is unquestionably a leading figure in the Christian.
Yeah, religion. Absolutely. Russell Moore is really interesting. I think I don't know how widely his presence is known yet outside the evangelical community and people who are paying a lot of attention, but he is definitely, as you said, a rising star in the Southern Baptist Convention. He is the author of a book called Adopting for Life, and that really lays out, in part, his personal story, his and his wife's personal story of adopting their two sons from what sounds like a pretty terrible Russian orphanage, and then kind of his starting to build, lay the groundwork for this adoption theology, this orphan theology that has become really popular in some evangelical churches in the past few years. So that book ended up being pretty huge in this movement. The SBC Theological Seminary dedicated an entire conference to it in 2009, and it's one of the kind of the touchstones of the other conferences and all the online dialogue that happens about this. Russell Moore also, within the Southern Baptist Convention, which is a huge denomination for any of the viewers who might not know, it's the second largest Christian denomination in the U.S. after the Catholic Church, so the largest Protestant denomination with about 16 million members. And they passed in 2009 a resolution that was written by Russell Moore, proposed and conceived by Russell Moore at least, talking about adoption and orphan care and the importance of Southern Baptists to get involved in this issue. So what they were saying is, everybody, all Christians are called to work on this issue in one sense or another. Maybe not every single person is called to adopt, but everybody is at least called to get involved in some way. So if you can't adopt, then you need to kind of donate money to other families who are adopting or support your local church orphan ministry that is working on adoption issues. So in this way, this is how a viral movement actually is built, is by people kind of laying the groundwork like this and saying, hey, everyone, this is our new mission. This is what we're getting involved in.
Well, one of the interesting things that you discuss in relation to Moore in the book is how he was critical of churches that he said had become fat and materialistic and comfortable and self-focused.
Right.
And that this was a rallying cry, not just for Christians to adopt, but also it was a criticism of what he thought the church had become, which coming from the inside, I thought was a fairly damning indictment.
Yeah, I think that reflects this idea that, Russell Moore was one of the people who told me that he felt evangelicals had wrongfully allowed, all of the good works, that Christians do, that they had allowed this to be taken on by mainline churches, by, churches that we don't think of as conservative evangelical churches. And he was saying, this is something that Christians need to get invested in again and need to be doing. The Christian mission is not to live in suburbia and have a big house and go to a nice megachurch. It's a call for people to get involved in some way. And the way that they found is the adoption movement, which, Russell Moore even compared to the civil rights movement of today in terms of its import and the imperative for conservative Christians to get involved.
That's sort of an interesting.
Yeah. It is.
Probably, I would question its aptness, but we can talk about that. So, as this movement is becoming more viral, you document how the notion of what is an orphan and exactly how many orphans there are in the world sort of took on a life of its own almost in terms of it not having particularly hard, concrete numbers or orphan even having a concrete, hard definition.
Right.
Because, I think of an orphan as someone who has lost both their parents, doesn't have a sibling, aunt, uncle, grandparent, extended family member who will take care of them.
Yep.
But as you talk about in the book, first of all, the numbers, in some cases, the numbers of orphans that people talked about seem to have been either taken out of thin air or exaggerated. But that in addition to that, it seemed to include or seek to include the definition of orphan as being a little bit less as being a little bit more expansive, I guess, than what I just described.
Right. Well, this takes a little bit of explanation. There is this very common term within the Christian adoption movement, and in some ways further beyond that, in kind of the broader kind of community. But this is a term that's very popular in the Christian adoption community, is the notion of an orphan crisis. And that's the idea that there are hundreds of millions of orphans around the world in need of help. And the strong implication for many years has been that these hundreds of millions of children are in need of Christian adoption by U.S. parents. So the numbers for this have varied a lot. When I first started reporting on this, people were talking about 143 million orphans around the world, and you would see that number everywhere. And as soon as you saw it, you kind of knew that this is what people are talking about. They're talking about the Christian adoption movement. If you saw it on T-shirts or on, like cause wristbands or on blog titles, 143 million, and you'd see names of blogs like 143 million minus one, which would be one person talking about their contribution to helping the orphans around the world is adopting one child out of that statistic. The numbers since then have kind of ballooned up further. People talk about 163 million. People talk about 210 million. There's a common problem with all of these numbers, whichever one you choose, in that they're taking a number from the humanitarian organization UNICEF and really misapplying it to a context of adoption. So where these numbers came from originally was a UNICEF tally of orphaned and vulnerable children around the world. So in that definition, which was a definition that was created in order to assess the number of children who are in need of various sorts of assistance and help or are vulnerable in vulnerable situations and might end up needing help. So this includes single orphans, which is any child who has lost one parent, so a child who is in a single parent family, and double orphans, children who have lost both parents, but many of those children also live with extended family. So this is a very wide net, and it's intended to be a wide net because it's intended to look at, you know, the broadest possible number of children who might need help. But instead, what we've seen as that term, the orphan crisis, has been picked up and used to apply to an adoption context in the U.S. and to rally U.S. Christian parents to get on board to adopt children and go through that whole process, that this is the way they can best help these hundreds of millions of children. We've seen that number kind of take on a life of its own and become something it was never meant to be. So it's really important to understand where that came from and what it actually means.
Right. I mean, because there are many children around the world, and I mean, obviously this is a terrible crisis in any event, right?
Yeah.
That are, you know, have been victims of war, civil war, famine, other kinds of strife. Right. I mean, you know, when you look around the world and you see what's happening in places like the Democratic Republic of Congo or Syria, or, you know, I mean, you realize that, yes, of course, you know, there are a lot of children in dire need around the world. It doesn't mean that they need an American couple to adopt them. but, you know, there is this, you know, salvation imperative embedded in the Christian adoption movement, whereby the adoptive parent has, that there's a religious imperative for the adoptive parent, but also that the child receives new life in Christ.
Yes. Yeah. There is, I mean, I kind of, in thinking about the various motivations for this movement, I've tended to think of that one as third or fourth, but there is absolutely a lot of missionary language that goes along with this movement. People talk about adoption as redeeming orphans, as kind of you're doing this dual salvation, you're saving them both body and soul, and this is why adoption kind of trumps any sort of aid that would keep children within their own communities or sometimes within their own families who could keep them if they had a little bit of help. That adoption allows you to be bringing children to Christ in a way that merely giving development aid or charity will not. And sometimes, you know, sometimes there is a little bit of ambiguity in the way they talk about this. I mean, speaking with leaders like Russell Moore and another really significant leader in this movement, Jed Metafint, about this, I asked them about the language that they frequently used, which was talking about adoption as a Great Commission mandate, the Great Commission being the biblical mandate for Christians to spread the gospel around the world. And what the two of them essentially told me is that the Great Commission to insiders has, to Christian, to believers, so they were saying this is kind of an inside-outside interpretation difference, that it can mean a number of things, and it doesn't just mean proselytizing. It can mean sharing Christ's love, which can mean sharing a cup of water with a thirsty child or sharing food. So in essence, that this is, you know, sharing Christ around the world by sharing practical assistance and practical help. But I think it's hard to think of that as solely that one definition when there are other evangelical leaders, sometimes, you know, the same one, Russell Moore has written a lot about this himself, talking about evangelism as inseparable from adoption, that there is no difference between adoption and missionary work. Or as another leader wrote, adoption is, you know, the chief purpose of adoption is not getting a needy child into a family that can care for him or her, as important as that is, but it's sharing the gospel. That is the ultimate purpose of adoption.
Right.
So, I mean, I think there is absolutely this kind of through line throughout a lot of this movement that is talking about evangelism as one part of the motivation.
And I think that you document a few cases. I mean, you document a few cases of people coming to realize that perhaps they have a cultural disconnect with the children or the culture from which the children that they seek to adopt, and they come to realize that they come to take a second look at what their motivations were. But one example of this, and you talk at length, you discuss at length some adoptions from Ethiopia, and that sort of struck me as another definitional issue in this movement, which is, in addition to the definition of who is an orphan and who needs to be adopted, there's a cultural disconnect or even a linguistic disconnect about what an adoption is. And I think that one of the Ethiopia stories that you told really highlighted this, where you know, a parent might bring a child to what a Westerner might think of as an orphanage just because they are, you know, cash strapped at the moment and their full intention is to come back for the child. They just think that this is going to take care of their child for a little bit, a short-term thing. And so, or that they might think that adoption means something different than what an American thinks adoption is. And they think that their kids are just being taken to the United States to get an education and then they're going to come back. And you document a couple of stories where this led to really kind of disastrous results over a misunderstanding of what these terms even mean, what adoption is and what an orphan is.
Right, yeah. There was one story that I followed for a lot of that chapter that ended up being really devastating. There was an adoptive family in the U.S. who saw a kind of like a video catalog that was prepared by a Christian adoption agency, and it showcased these three sisters, these three Ethiopian sisters, and said, you know, they're desperately poor, their mother died of HIV/AIDS, their father is also sick and soon to die, and if nobody helps these children, they're going to end up being prostitutes. So, you know, it's this really hard emotional sell sometimes that you need to act now. So these parents, who were fairly young at the time, ended up embarking on this adoption. That the girls also were all, their ages were given at much altered ages from reality. They were, right. You know, in one mm-hmm. case, one of them was twice as old almost as she was listed as. She was, I think, initially said to be 7 and then ended up being 13. So these parents, who I think were in their, you know, mid-late 20s, were ending up adopting children who were much older and who the parents, therefore, were perhaps, you know, less best suited to adopt. But on the other side, in Ethiopia, these girls were actually the children of an intact family. The mother had died, yes, but of childbirth years before. The family had been struggling somewhat, but within the context of a small Ethiopian city, this was actually a middle-class family. The father had a stable mm-hmm. job with the government. He was a government clerk. There were older sisters and brother who were variously in school or in college or working as teachers. These girls were not about to enter prostitution. These girls were not about to be thrown on the street. What they had, in fact, experienced is at their church, somebody from an orphanage sort of organization had come and presented and said, you know, there are these opportunities to be adopted to the U.S. And the way that this had been presented was that adoption is a way for children to go to the U.S., receive a wonderful education, and most likely return, you know, within a couple of years, or at least when they're 18, and be better able to help the family. So within the context of a developing world where often children will, you know, go abroad, work in a job, send money home, or come home with money, and the whole family benefits, you can see how these misunderstandings become really kind of endemic to the process.
So these girls were actually legally adopted by an American family, and they didn't realize.
They didn't realize until they got there, were given new names, were told to call these strangers mom and dad. And, you know,
And these were girls who were what, like 7, 8, 9, 13, 14?
Yeah, in that range. Yeah. You know, 7, mm-hmm. I think 7 to 13. And so coming to the U.S. and realizing that this is not at all what you've been told, that this is not what you understand your family was told, and then being told that this really can't be fixed because, you know, the adoptive parents in this case realized what was happening, felt terrible, felt like they had also been taken in and used, but looked into the possibility right. of kind of annulling the adoption and sending the children back, and found that there was not a legal, safe way to do so, that would resemble abandonment.
Oh, my God. So, you know, if you do a domestic adoption, you have to present evidence that you received the consent of the birth parents, if both, you know, if the father also can be found, to the adoption. So how does it happen when you do an international adoption? Or was there consent, but the father in Ethiopia wasn't fully informed of what he was consenting to? I mean, as a legal process matter, how did this happen and turn out this way?
Well, I think a key thing to understand is what you alluded to earlier, that there is just a very different cultural understanding of adoption. So when I went to Ethiopia, I spoke not with a father who was away for work in another town, but I spoke with the older sisters who had become caregivers for the family, and they said that this had been presented to them as an educational opportunity, that it was not presented to them as though this was severing of family ties, that this meant, you know, it was forever, that these were no longer, you know, their children, their sisters. And if that had been made clear to them, they never would have done it. And that's something that, right. you know, is a story that was heard again and again and again. This was not just a bad apple story, but there are many, some birth families, as they're called, in Ethiopia, who have complained about this to the government or, you know, to various ministries. There are many adoptive parents who have found the same thing, or who have returned to the villages that their children came from, or hired somebody to investigate and found out, you know, that things were not at all as they appeared to be.
Right. You actually talk about a man who is hired by adoptive parents as a
right.
searcher for the birth families when they discover that there's been this just devastating, tragic, it's not really a misunderstanding because there are people in the mediating this who fully understand
yeah.
it, right? It's just that the birth parents did not understand what they were
right.
consenting to, right? I mean, it's just kind of mind-boggling to me.
Yeah.
And I think it was to one of the families that you profiled in the book, one of the adoptive families, when they found out what they had basically unwittingly done.
Yeah, I mean, there are. It's an incredible story that's very common. One of the stories I wrote about in the book was a mother whose daughter was adopted, and she was told that, you know, nobody knew who the mother was, and, you know, this child was just abandoned and needed to find a home. And when the girl gets home, a small girl, I think she was 4 or 5, and begins to learn English, what happened, I think, is something that's been repeated in many other homes. This girl told her, you know, I have another mommy. And, you know, the adoptive mother at the time was like, no, you know, you didn't know me then. And the girl had to stick by her story. And this happens a lot, is that, you know, the children come and they are the ones who inform the adoptive parents that whatever information the adoptive parents received from the agency sometimes is very far from the truth. Birth parents who were said to be dead are alive. You know, there are siblings, there are other family members who are in the picture. You know, they weren't abandoned. The mother was not raped. You know, this was the product of a relationship. They're just mm-hmm. absolutely routine to find inaccuracies in the story that you're told from adoption agencies, so much so that it became standard in some adoption agency agreements that parents had to accept that what they were told was the backstory of their child might not be true. And I just think that's astounding to me, that you have to legally agree that you might be accepting a lie.
Yeah. That seems hard to, I mean, I think a lot of people who are in the adoption process, it's hard when you're that far in the adoption process to back away from it and say, no, this adoption is not going forward. So in a way, it's taking advantage of the adoptive parents. So
absolutely.
It's like
escape clause. They're tens of thousands of dollars in to this process. You know, a lot of times they've tapped their retirement fund.
Not to mention their emotional investments.
Of course.
In it, right?
Of course.
And so are these agencies that have done these things, are some of them agencies that have held themselves, adoption agencies that held themselves out as Christian adoption agencies?
Yes, frequently. In all the cases that I wrote about in that chapter, yes, they were Christian agencies. And I think the problems, the ethical problems with adoption are not limited to these agencies, but anecdotally, there seems to be some consensus among adoptive parents and adoption reformers that some of the worst abuses happen with these Christian agencies. And I even spoke with a representative for kind of a trade organization for adoption service providers and people who work in that field. And he even told me that, you know, sometimes the abuses are greater with Christian agencies and Christians who are involved in the whole adoption world, because there is this sense of doing things kind of by whatever means necessary, that as long as you're getting a child out, whatever you have to do, if you need to, you know, commit fraud on, you know, a visa application, if you need to bend the truth or bend the story, that this is all justified because you're doing it in the name of a higher good. So I think, you know, this is seriously a case of good intentions in many cases, really kind of leading down the path to hell.
So what eventually happened with the three girls who had been quote unquote adopted from Ethiopia? So once they were adopted, when you're adopted internationally, then do you have to separately go through a process to become an American citizen?
I mean, that depends. That's kind of a different thing depending on what orphan visa you come into the U.S. on. So in some cases, being adopted abroad, you are automatically a citizen when you come home. And in some other cases, there's a separate process.
So did these girls eventually go back to Ethiopia, and were they reunited with their family there?
Well, this family adopted three children, and for the two younger children, they ended up staying with the adoptive parent, with the oldest child, who I spent a lot of time with, talking with, because she was 13 when she came, because she had had, you know, almost, she was, you know, halfway grown, more than halfway grown to adulthood when she was adopted. It was much, I mean, I can't say if it was much harder, but she had an extremely difficult time adjusting to this new reality that had been forced on her, that suddenly here she was thinking she was going like to a study abroad program, and no, now she's adopted to America and she can't see her family again. And, you know, sometimes like,
so how old is she now?
She's a young adult now, looking at colleges. But
So she's still in the United States,
but the adoption did not work out because there. I think, you know, if I would say my opinion, that it was based on kind of this tremendous hurt and this tremendous amount of fraud that hurt everybody in that entire relationship. And so it didn't work out with the first adoptive family, and it also didn't work out with the second adoptive family, who were relatives of the first. And so she ended up living with another family that had adopted younger children, and that has worked out well, but she's a young adult and she's moving on with her life and hoping to do a lot of things focusing on adoption reform and the corruption in the system here in Ethiopia.
Interesting. Now, has Ethiopia tightened the system since these occurrences, or are these things still happening coming out of Ethiopia?
Well, I mean, it's an interesting thing. In 2011, so the thing about adoption to realize is that there is, in so many countries, there is the same sort of boom-bust cycle that happens. A country that doesn't have a huge number of intercountry adoptions all of a sudden kind of becomes the focus of many adoption service providers and agencies who move in, and kind of quickly this becomes an industry. In the case of Ethiopia, at first the agencies were, because they didn't know how to identify children who were available for adoption, some of them were working with local people who ended up essentially becoming child finders, people who were being paid as much as $5,000 per child that they could identify and help bring to the adoption agency as an adoptable child. So considering what the average income is for people in Ethiopia, this was about 10 times more than that. So if you can make 10 times an average income by finding one child in a poor country who you can say is available to go for adoption, you can imagine what this leads to is a lot of these child finders going and recruiting children from intact families to match the description of whatever U.S. parents and, you know, European parents were saying they were looking for, a 3-year-old girl, you know, a 12-month-old baby. So this quickly did become an industry, and there was a lot of trickle-down kind of economic benefits to that as well, in terms of the huge numbers of Western parents, would-be parents, who were coming to the country to adopt. So all of this in time, in this kind of boom-bust cycle, those patterns repeat themselves. And eventually, when you have kind of the industry operating at peak, then the abuses start to come out. And the stories, stories of fraudulent adoption or coerced birth families or, you know, abused children start to come to the forefront. And then eventually the government is forced to react. So in 2011, that seemed to have happened in Ethiopia. And there was a slowdown imposed in the adoptions for a short period of time. The ministry that was kind of overseeing the process said they were going to reduce the number of cases that they were reviewing by 90%, from 50 a day down to 5 a day. And this kind of, this news was greeted with panic, like absolute panic in the United States. And people were talking about, you know, the Ethiopian government holding these children hostage. And, you know, we needed to do something about this. But so that there was a slowdown for a short period of time. But then what I heard was within months, things had kind of crept back up to their normal levels. Right. So it's hard to say exactly what's happening now, but people are certainly looking to the next country. What is going to be the next country if Ethiopia is not going to be, I mean, to use kind of the crass commercial terms, I mean, it does become a supply and demand chain. So if Ethiopia is not going to be the reliable providing supply chain.
You talk in the book a bit about this idea of like, what's the next country going to be? And you mentioned that some people have brought up the DRC, which has been, you know, enmeshed in this horrifically brutal civil war for years. And, you know, there's another story that you tell in the book about another African country, which had been embroiled in a civil war with Liberia, with families deciding that Liberia was the place to adopt from because there were children orphaned, using that term loosely, by the ravages of the civil war there, but that these parents were completely unprepared and I think in some cases unwilling to even acknowledge that these children, some of them, were suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder. I mean, the idea that you can go from war-ravaged Liberia, where you saw people, children being killed, to rural Tennessee, and that there would be a sort of seamless transition to your American life, just seemed sort of, you know, it was kind of mind-boggling to me.
Yeah, I think, you know, in that case, that was a very tragic case in which kind of Liberia became the hot spot, not just for Christian adoption in general, but for a particular subcommunity, which tended to be much more conservative, probably could even say fundamentalist Christian rather than evangelical. And this became, you know, through kind of the promotion and kind of the, you know, campaigning of a particular fundamentalist organization and associated media, this became a real interesting and tragic kind of mini boom when a lot, maybe about 1,000 Liberian children were coming directly after, within the first couple of years after the end of their own civil war, which was years and years in the making and was just absolutely brutal. Many children, including many older children who had witnessed firsthand really just devastating violence, really probably violence that we can't quite imagine, were being adopted in huge numbers to very conservative, fundamentalist homeschooling families. And, you know, while some of those adoptions worked out, a troubling number of them did not and resulted in some cases of like serious conflict, allegations of serious abuse, and a large number of disruptions, which is kind of...
And including one child you discuss in the book, it was sent back to Liberia by the adoptive parents with $40.
Right. That was one child who I spoke with and worked with his family at great length, Isaiah, who lives with the Thompson family. And that was a particularly tragic story. And unfortunately is once again, is not an isolated experience. When I was in Liberia, I met another, child who had been sent back by his Liberian parents and left there. He showed me his U.S. passport. He said, "How do I get back home?" I spoke with a street preacher there who took in children who were returned by their U.S. adoptive parents, you know, for various reasons, because there was a lot of sexual acting out because the adoptive parents had not been adequately prepared for how to integrate these children who had been institutionalized in institutions where there was frequently a lot of sexual abuse into their families and had not, you know, had the preparation or kind of the willingness to institute protections for the entire family. So, you know, some children were being sent back for sexual acting out, some for rebelliousness, some for PTSD outbursts, which, you know, that the family did not know how to process or was not willing to understand how to process. So
how much self-reflection has gone on among Christian adoption advocates about how to address these, you know, failures within the system, you know, either failures of acknowledging or being aware of the circumstances from which these adopted children come, or failures such as, you know, outright fraud in terms of, you know, portraying these children as orphans when they're not, or portraying to the birth parents that the adoption means something other than what adoption means, with, you know, lifelong lasting legal consequences. How much self-reflection has there been to address those kinds of issues?
Well, I mean, it varies. I think that some of the organizations are admirably trying to shift their focus. The Christian Alliance for Orphans released a white paper last year trying to clarify the numbers around that surround the orphan crisis, the 143 million or the 163 million or the 210 million number, and mm-hmm. trying to say we really need to be more responsible about how we use this number, and you know the way we've been using it is really you know kind of allowing and encouraging some of these abuses. So I thought that was a positive mm-hmm. step. I know some mm-hmm. other organizations and some other individuals have been trying to shift their own attention or shift the attention of the movement more towards efforts that are about family preservation or caring for vulnerable children within their own communities and families, doing various things, supporting women so they are able to, you know, have daycare. They can leave their child in daycare and then go and find, right. you know, work so they'd be able to support their family and stay together, which is, if you think about it, that's the sort of kind of respect that we, you know, hopefully would show or more frequently at least show for families in the U.S. is, you know, we don't necessarily say, oh, you're a poor mother. We need to take your child away. Obviously, sometimes that happens too. But so I think that there are initiatives to do more of this. However, I think too often a lot of these conversations about how Christians can more responsibly engage this problem and promote the sort of kind of work that is going to be better for the entire kind of the entire problem, which is less a problem of an orphan crisis and more a problem of poverty and violence and you know, instability, right. that these things kind of are large holistic problems that need to be addressed rather than just taking children for adoption. I think, unfortunately, some of those conversations are happening behind closed doors, and that's not being adequately reflected in how leaders speak to the, you know, the actual lay people in this movement, mm-hmm. who are right. still being told, you know, as Rick Warren said, at, you know, last year at the last Christian Alliance for Orphan Summit, and which he kind of echoed again on his Twitter feed several months ago, that, you know, orphan care means adoption first, second, and last. So, you know, among some leaders, there's this kind of, there is some are doing helpful things, I think, to broaden the conversation, and some seem to be digging in their heels and, you know, asserting that, you know, no, there aren't significant problems with adoption.
Adoption is the answer. Right.
I mean, I think a lot of them are invested in this because of the symbolism it's taken on within their movement and because of all of the kind of mm-hmm. discussion and writing and literature that has been produced talking about adoption as this perfect mirror of, you know, the Christian experience, the Christian salvation experience. And now I think some of them are finding it hard to walk away from.
Right, right. Well, listen, thanks so much for talking today about the book and for the book. I highly recommend it.
Thank you so much, Sarah.
Okay. Bye-bye. Thanks, Catherine.